Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. I'm a former aerobatics display pilot from the South African Air Force and I love talking about high performance teams, what makes them work and what we can all learn from them. In the show, we talk to race pilots, professional sportsmen and women, entrepreneurs, comedians, performing artists and more. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe. Well, I was really, really excited for this conversation. This was more than a year in the making. Richard Koch, the author of several great, great books, famously the 80-20 principle, which a lot of people know as the Pareto principle, which is the principle of 80% of the value comes from 20% of your effort, or 20% of your clothes you wear 80% of the time. And there's so many examples in life where the 80-20 principle works. And Richard Koch was the author of that great book called the 80-20 principle. Also, the STAR principle is another great book, and Unreasonable Success and How to Achieve It. Read all these books recently and reached out to Richard and he made himself available. And it was a real privilege to have this conversation with Richard Koch. Richard, it is wonderful to connect with you. I'm very pleased and privileged to have this time with you. Thank you so much. And how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks very much, Alex. And it's very, very nice talking to you as well.
Are you doing a standing interview?
Yes, I'm actually, I have a stand-up desk. They're wonderful. Everyone should have a stand-up desk. I can actually move up and down, so I'll just make a noise to show you. There, I'm disappearing, aren't I? I'm getting bigger.
Well, I'm at a studio now where they've just recently modified it. There's a standing desk behind me outside of the studio, but there's a co-working space. And when I saw it, I thought that's brilliant because standing is the way to go.
It is. It is. I mean, if you feel really tired, you can sit down. But it's. I find that I think better. In fact, I think best of all when I'm walking. So when I have someone out that I want to talk to, and effectively do talk about strategy of business for a couple of days or whatever, we just go for walks, and it's absolutely marvelous. So I recommend standing up.
If you can't walk,
stand, but don't sit.
Okay, well, I'm going to edit. I've set my camera up at the right height for sitting for today, so I'm not going to change it this time, but I'm going to take you up on that in the next interview I do. I'm going to do standing. So, but it's great to connect with you, and, I've read a lot of your books, and the one that stands out the most for me is the 80-20 principle, which I want to get into. I also want to talk about your Unreasonable Success book, which is also wonderful. But I do like to start, just like peel back the layers a bit Tim Ferriss-esque, where we go back a little bit and say, you know, at the time of your life where you were impressionable and you were looking out to wonderful things that maybe sort of last couple of years of schooling, you know, high schooling, what was the thing that was catching your attention and what was interesting to you? What was the young Richard going after in life?
Gosh, it's a long time ago. I regret to say it was probably the usual, you know, girls, parties, drinking, that sort of thing. But I've always been very interested in reading and in ideas, and always very keen on making money. Have I told you a story about my 9-year-old encounter with Miss Gates? I think it's actually in Unreasonable Success, but. Would you like me to repeat that?
Yeah, but yes, please repeat that story. It's a good story.
Well, it's not like I'm trying to do what they do on chat shows. They always say, you know, can you tell that particular story? And usually a lot of people on chat shows are great celebrities and they're great artists, but they're actually fairly inarticulate. So they have to be led and sort of, you know, say, oh, tell that story because there's a limited number of stories. But anyway, one of my limited number of stories is about when I was 9 years old, about nine. My parents and I went to see our favorite auntie, Auntie Louise. And she lived in a very nice big house on the south coast of England where people go to die, basically called Seaford. Okay. And we went to see Auntie. But the thing was, we hated going, and we didn't hate going because of Auntie. We hated going because of her companion. So she had a live-in companion called Evelyn Gates, but she was never called Evelyn. She was always Miss Gates, which was very puzzling because she'd had a son, and I'm sure she must have been married at some stage. And I don't know what happened, whether they got divorced or whether the chap died or whatever it was, or whether she did him in. No, it's, sorry, I shouldn't suggest that, you know. Anyway, she caught me one day, and we were all absolutely terrified of Miss Gates. She was a really fierce lady, and she would interrogate you. You know, and you know nowadays they have all these, you know, Rottweiler interviewers who try and skewer the politicians and the rest of it. Well, Miss Gates wanted to skewer me. And okay. She said, Richard, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I hadn't got the faintest idea what I wanted to do, but you had to answer, Miss Gates. You couldn't say, I don't know. So I said, the first thing that came into my head was, I want to be a millionaire. And she said, nonsense. For a start, being a millionaire is not a job. It's a result. And secondly, your father has got no money and never will have. And so the idea that you can become a millionaire is complete, utter fantasy. So now, answer the question properly. So by then I was very embarrassed and also a bit petulant. And I said, I want to be a millionaire. So I kept repeating it. Now, the truth is, I didn't actually want to be a millionaire very much. But having said it to Miss Gates, I thought, yes, that's probably right. I do want to be. And if I can become a millionaire, I could really piss off Miss Gates. I could really make her miserable, which was at the time was my objective. No great.
At a similar kind of age,
I can tell you, but
at a similar kind of age in my life as well, there was this house down the road in Cape Town, which you're familiar with, and it was a seaside house in St. James down in the sort of southern suburbs of Cape Town. I'm not sure how familiar you are with all the areas, but it was a beautiful big old house. And the story was that this house was sold for $1 million. And around about 9, 10 years old, you know, I'd never heard that anything could be worth $1 million. Now, obviously, we're talking rands at that point in the sort of early to mid-1980s. But this thing, like it went for R1 million. That was incredible to me. So, yeah, I mean, this fascination with being a millionaire, that's I suppose there's a lot of excitement in that.
Yeah, it gave me a bit of a focus. I did actually start a business when I was 13, selling stamps to schoolboys, basically, on approval, we used to call it. I don't know if that's a phrase you're familiar with. But basically, you'd put stamps in a little book, you'd mail it out to people, they would take out the stamps they wanted to buy, and in those days, they'd send you a postal order for it, which was, that's before PayPal and all the rest of it. And it was before people would steal the stamps and not return the books and not pay you any money. But anyway, that was a business I started when I was 13, and I did it for 3 years. I made a little bit of money out of it. It was great. It's really good.
Okay, so you planted the seed of being... Yeah, about being a millionaire, and then, sorry, we have a bit of a delay, and I think I keep talking on top of you, but I want to carry on to the point where you get to study after school. Now, you're at college, university, and the idea of business had already bit by then, having planted the seed for yourself about being a millionaire. Was that the logical step, was to go into business-type training, or how did you end up in the course that you studied?
I really should have done, but I wanted to do history. I did economics. We do A-levels. That's the sort of thing you do before you go to varsity in England. And one of my A-levels was economics, so that had something to do with business. But the other ones were theology, and not that I wanted to become a priest or anything, but I was just fascinated by it all, and also history. History was the thing that I really loved, so I went to read history at university. And they told me that employers in those days didn't care, you know, what degree you had. They just cared whether that it was a very good degree or they liked you for one reason or another. And so, I'm going to have to switch my Outlook on. Sorry, I didn't realize that it was on. Yes, where was I? Yes, so I studied history, and then when I finished my degree, or about a year before finishing, I suddenly thought, oh, I've got to get a job. What will I do? So I interviewed with journalists because I thought maybe I wanted to be a newspaper person. And I interviewed with all of the biggest companies that would pay the most money. And I actually got offered a job by the South Shields Gazette. That sounds, South Shields is a very obscure place. Sorry if you're from South Shields, anyone that's listening. It's a lovely place. But it's a very small place in the northeast of England, and it's very cold there. And I remember they offered to pay me £660 a year. And the alternative was to go and work for Shell, and they offered to pay me £1,500 a year. I mean, these numbers all sound absurdly small these days. But, of course, inflation has taken its toll, and it's probably you can multiply that by 10 or even more. So it wasn't a very difficult decision. Obviously, my desire to be a journalist wasn't that strong after all. And then I went to work for Shell. And,
okay, but before you hang on, I'm going to just pause you. I'm going to pause you a bit there because now you glossed over a little bit too fast. And the point at university, where you uncover the Pareto principle, and I love the way you described it on the interview with Tim Ferriss as well. But you, I mean, what was it that that made you? I mean, were you obviously naturally inclined to want to get the most and extract the most value from a said portion of energy or time or, you know, expense? That must have been your sort of way of thinking anyway. Were you familiar with Pareto at this point, or was it just when you read this, I gather it was a French version of the Pareto principle?
I became, Alex, familiar with him from reading the book which he wrote, which was about 1896 and 1897. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a sort of textbook of economics, really. And why was I reading this? I have absolutely no idea why I was reading it. But one of the things about the library in Oxford that I was reading in, the Bodleian, beautiful circular building in Oxford, was that you could order any book at all, because it's one of the very few copyright libraries in the world, which means that they've got every single book that anyone's written.
Oh,
and
wow.
underneath this building, there are huge stacks which have got all these books. I mean, it probably goes under the whole of Broad Street in Oxford.
Sure.
So it takes a bit of time to order a book, but if you get there early, you can sort of, you know, scatter your pieces of paper around. And if you've got nothing to do until the books arrive, you just go off for a cup of coffee and come back an hour later, and then you've got a huge pile of books waiting for you. And one of the things that I've always done is just read very, very widely. And perhaps a mate of mine who was studying politics, philosophy and economics at Oxford said, you should read this, Richard. It's you'd be interested in it. I don't know why. But I was absolutely fascinated by this idea. He didn't use the phrase 80-20, but he did look at the distribution of wealth in England and France and Italy and everywhere else he could get the data, and he looked at it for the 19th century, which was then now, of course, and 18th century, 17th century, and he saw this distribution, which was amazingly precise. And nowadays he'd draw a chart, but he just used algebra. And he said, you know, this is unbelievable, that if you take the top any percent of people, he didn't particularly go for 20%, you know, if you take the top 5% or 10% or 15% or 20%, the number of people is defined by that. But the amount of wealth which those people had was almost exactly the same. So 15% of the top 15% would have, you know, I don't know, 80-something percent. And It was a linear relationship within the relationship, so you could draw a straight line through it. And also, it was the same, virtually the same curve, virtually the same algebraic expression, no matter which time period you took or which country you took. So he seemed to imply that there was something deep buried in the universe. I mean, I don't even... People didn't talk about the universe like that those days, but he really felt that he'd made a discovery which was very important. And I was saying, well, this could help me in my history exam, because you have to do 11 papers of 3 hours at the end of your time as an undergraduate at Oxford. And it's still true now, I think.
That's a lot of work.
And you get a list of about 60 questions, and you only have to answer 3 or 4 of those questions. And so I thought that what I would do was discover the questions which had been asked most frequently and see whether they actually came up regularly. And so I got the papers for the last 20 years, the examination papers, and there was a Pareto distribution. There was an 80-20 distribution. And there were some questions which always or almost always came up. So there's always a question about the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the causes of the Second World War or the First World War or whatever. So I reckoned that if I could take 6 subjects and really absolutely conquer them, murder them, you know, sort of knew everything about them and worked out my arguments, I wouldn't have to do all the work of reading all the other things that you might have to do. So I could just concentrate on 6 subjects, get them fantastically well mugged up on, and I could do less work than most of my colleagues who were, you know, who never actually thought about asking which questions come up most often. I suppose you don't actually really need the 80-20 principle to do that, but that's how I got into it. And I since it worked for me, in everything, I was always looking for the 20% that actually gave you 80% of results. So I was always looking for the companies that paid the most money. I was always looking for the companies that gave the best training. And I was always looking for the ideas which were most useful and could be used in almost any area, which were general principles, well, like the 80-20 principle.
That sounds great.
I didn't find very many other ones,
I just wanted to ask you now, at the time, I know we'll get to gambling later. I know you enjoy a bit of a gamble too, but did you consider it a gamble, or was this something that was, you found like you unlocked a bit of a secret to you know, studying at university level, or was it did it feel like a bit gamble-esque at that point?
Well, I knew that, you know, they always say that, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future performance, which is one of the most stupid things that most people say, and a lot of stupid things that most people say. But no, I mean, I thought it was very unlikely that they would suddenly break the pattern. But you never know, do you? You know, I mean, there might have been a different person setting the exam questions. They might have woken up to the fact that perhaps some people were doing this. So you never knew. But I was pretty sure that it was a good bet. And even if it hadn't been a good bet, in every paper, which it was, it would work in some of them anyway. And so I was confident in doing this. I thought this was a very sensible thing to do, because I just was not prepared to spend my time in the library when there were other things which were much more interesting, like going hunting or going to balls or just reading and talking to people.
Some
of the other extracurricular activities.
So the way you describe it in the 80-20 principle in the book, you describe using the most valuable, get the most value out of those, the 20% of the things that bring the most value, and use your other time to relax and enjoy. So even at university, you were kind of distilling the principles of this book, which was only going to come 15 or 20 or whatever number of years later.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it is amazing. No one ever said to me, until I met an editor after I'd written one book, I was more than 40 years old by that time, and no one said to me, you should write a book about the 80-20 principle. It's sort of pretty obvious, really, now, looking back. But at the time, I thought, well, it's very simple. You can just write it down on one page, and people will get the idea. But that doesn't happen. You know, when you're reading a book, you want to make it interesting. You want lots of stories in it. You want to explore a bit more deeply, you know, some of the aspects of it.
I do want to explore them a bit more deeply, but before we get to the sort of the detail of the book, I want to just track the journey a little bit longer and then get to the book in the right sort of sequential time. So you describe in your book that you didn't enjoy your time too much at Shell, and you were quickly looking for the next thing. Was the job after Shell directly into the consulting, or did you have to go to the business school first? You went to the United States on the business school.
No, I went to Wharton first. I went from the frying pan into the fire because I left Shell, and then I joined a company called Pedigree Pet Foods. And I tell you, and it's okay. The first month, what they had was they had been working on the production line, tearing this polythene apart from the chicken wings and chicken pieces, revolting stuff, all from China, even then. And it smelt horrible. And I had to sort of take the stuff and dump it in the hopper along with all the other stuff. I was working on the production line. I thought,
it doesn't sound like
Jesus,
fun.
I didn't go to Oxford. No, it didn't sound like fun. It wasn't fun. It was awful. But having done it, of course, I was very glad to have done it because it made me realize how dreadful it was to work in a factory. And, how thankful I am. That was the only time I've ever done it. It was a good way of getting to know some of the people that I would be working with later.
Okay, but you decided business school, and then that was even worse. Oh, sorry. Carry on. I interrupted you there.
Off to the United States to go to business school. Yeah, it was. I very much enjoyed my time in Philadelphia. A couple of years. It was wonderful, and it was very liberating because by that stage I was exploring my sexuality and various other things, and it was much easier to do that in America, where people were more open-minded. At least they were open-minded in universities and on the campus.
Okay. You mentioned something specifically about that, where your time at the business school, that the academics and the business side of the school wasn't as valuable to you as the sort of approach to life in business and communication and being a bit more, for lack of a better word, a bit more showy, showman, the stiff upper lip British comes through and then you go to the United States. Tell me a little bit more about that, because that's one of those worldly experiences that some people do and don't realize that they've been transformed by it, and you had it, and you actually noted that at the time that this is the benefit that you're getting right here is actually the get yourself out there kind of benefit.
One of the great things about Wharton is it has a very large number of foreign students. And, of course, there are Americans, which, of course, are truly wonderful. But there were also, some very good friends. There was one who was from Peru, one from Argentina, a couple of other people from Latin America. So I got to know really well. Frogs, there were some French people that I'm still in touch with today. And there were people from, from Germany, from all sorts of countries, including, there were some people from South Africa even, and Australia and New Zealand. So it was meeting those people and noting that in the discussion, and a lot of the lecturing was actually very interactive. And so, you were called upon to actually answer questions, or you could put your hand up and ask questions yourself. And I noticed that, again, this fits in with A20. I never really thought of a connection, but it wasn't the brightest people who had the most airtime. It was actually the people who were most confident. And often that confidence was misplaced because they weren't very brilliant. But they got marks for, completely different continuous assessment system that I'd never. You got marks for being extrovert, essentially. Because in a way it was fair because it got the discussion going. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do well at the business school, I've got to become extrovert. And I've got to, talk when sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about. Whereas in England, you'd sort of, be very, very cautious about saying something, particularly at Oxford, because you said something stupid and the professor would jump down your throat sometimes, sometimes nicely, sometimes not so nicely. And they'd tear it apart and they'd be very precise and analytical. But in Wharton, it was kind of much more sort of feel the width of the experience. Don't worry too much about the detail and try and get controversy going. So it's a little bit like television, you know, where you have, you know, one person from the left or one person from the right, or, you know, people, and they conflict with each other. And that was good theatre. But it also made a very good, interesting learning experience, because I, you know, one of the things that I'd realized then, which I never realized before, was that education was not just a matter of the mind. It was also a matter of enthusiasm. And it was also a matter of taking a particular line on something and being articulate and expressing it. Whereas previously, although there's the Oxford Union, very world-famous debating club, I was always terrified about speaking at the Oxford Union, didn't do it very often. But I overcame that fear, and it was, you know, now I can rabbit on about anything, as you're finding out.
There's a definite value.
It was very revealing.
There's a value in sort of the selling yourself aspect of it, which is what, you know, Americans are famous for that. And, you know, in a typical salesman kind of way, if you can't sell yourself, no one else is going to sell you. But also, if you can't sell your product, no one's going to buy it. You know, there's value in that for business.
Yes, absolutely. And I think everyone should be permitted to exaggerate a little bit anyway about how good they are and what they've done. And it just makes you sound more authoritative and more interesting.
I'm going to write that down. I'm quoting you. Yeah. So after Wharton, it's now time to get involved in consulting, and you get involved with BCG, the Boston Consulting Group. This is a post back in the United UK or in the United States?
No, I went back to the UK. I was the only one in my cohort of people who won the same scholarship. There were about half a dozen of us who won something called the Turon Award, very generously given by the Turon family. The other 11 people stayed in the United States. Some of them got married and became Americans almost immediately. I wanted to get back to the UK for personal reasons. And so I managed, though, to get the best of both worlds, because I managed to work for an American company in London. And it was much more interesting in London than it was in Boston, because at that stage, London was about 12 people. And Boston at that stage was about 100 people or something like that. And okay. So you had a sense that you were a pioneer, and it was a very good bonding experience with the people, most of whom were very, very, not only incredibly smart people, much smarter than me, but also pretty nice people. For, you know, people who are in business are often a bit sort of, you know, sharp elbows and just me, and sort of driven to achieve personal success. But in BCG, it was a wonderful combination of the business side of things and money making, because it was a very profitable organization and they paid very well, with almost an intellectual interest in the subject. So we felt that we're on the forefront of trying to discover what is it that makes companies successful. And we came up with an answer. Of course, there are lots of valid answers to that question, but we came up with an answer which was extremely reductionist and said, actually, it's a star business, which means that it's got to be the leader in a high growth market. And it's amazing the power of this idea. I've written a book called The Star Principle about this. Not terribly original, but just explaining what the idea was and what my own personal experience was. Because when I later became an investor, after I'd stopped being a consultant, I wouldn't make an investment unless it was a star business. And the result of that was that my investments, although there were some that were unsuccessful, quite a few of them were extremely successful, because a star business will grow in value, can grow in value very fast, not just because of the market growth, but because if you manage to establish a gap between yourself and the next largest competitor, it probably means that you've got a big price advantage or cost advantage or both. So, you know, you can do two things with that. One is you can go faster than the market. Even if the market's growing at 30% or even 100%, you can grow at 100% or 300%. So you can increase the size of the business, but you can also increase the profitability dramatically. And, you know, you've only got to look at what has been the theme in the public markets, let alone the private markets, in the last 10 years. How would you make more money than other people in the last 10 years in the stock market? Well, you would have bought the American megacorps, basically, you know, the Amazons and the eBays and the Googles, and later the Ubers, and so on, because those are star businesses par excellence. They're virtual monopolies in many cases, Facebook as well. You know, their profitability, once they actually start to try and make money and they overcome, you know, the job of making themselves so much bigger and so much better than other players, that there's almost nobody in their markets. And so that's the way to make money. Well, if you can do that with a public company, it's so much easier to do that with a private company, because you don't have all the business of regulation. You don't have to, you know, have boards of directors, and you don't have to be basically in the public eye, and you don't have to perhaps deal with antitrust or things like that. So in the private sector, where things are not quoted on the stock market, and also because they're young and they start from a lower base, you can get 100 times your money in some of those circumstances. So that has been the theme. And another way of saying that is that the most successful businesses in the public markets and in the unquoted markets in the last 10 years, and in my case, in the last 37 years, have been star businesses.
Okay, well, I just want to try and tie together a few things, because we're kind of diving into a bit of the book, but it also ties together the career progression as well. So BCG and the link between BCG and then Bain, you know, the high growth Boston Box. A message that you shared in your book too was how you got the job with, I think it was Bruce Henderson, the interview, and you'd said something which gave gave him the insight that you ask things a little differently and you do things a little differently, but you can also find the gems out there. So high growth in BCG, even higher growth at Bain, and then you go out on your own with LEK, and then you demand an even higher growth, almost unheard of, 100% growth per year. So I wonder if you could just share with me what it was that you did that was so different, and why. How is it that, was this the 80-20 principle that was just coming out in lots of different places that hadn't really been formalized or put down? Or what was it that you learned or you did differently that made you stand out such that you could hop between a couple of different places and eventually start your own and develop these sort of almost an eye for a great business?
Well, I did it on the coattails of Bain & Company very substantially. So it isn't that I was very different until starting with two other guys, our firm, LEK. But Bain & Company was a complete revelation. It was really based on the 80-20 principle, although they didn't really talk about the 80-20 principle. But everything that Bill Bain did was directed to finding the businesses which were going to be most successful or making them most successful. So when Bain & Company started its discussions with the head of a company, with the chief executive usually, or sometimes the president of the company, they would do something that no other consultant in the world did, mm-hmm. which was they would pretend, or they would aspire to, or they would insist on equality between the partner from Bain & Company that was leading the case team and the chief executive. And these are chief executives of very, very big companies. So no one ever tried to say, you know, basically, Alex, it's you and me. And if you take Bain & Company on, we need to agree what our budget's going to be. And it will be very high budget and it will keep going up because we'll make more and more money for you. They established this relationship with the chief executive probably over several months. I saw it being done in a couple of cases where I was able to either sit in on the meetings, or because it was goldfish bowl, you could see the body language as you were walking past. And Chief executives have never been treated in that way before. You know, consultants always had an inferiority complex. Mm. They were always sort of, you know, desperate to get the next job. And they, you know, really wanted to work for these companies. Well, Bain said, you know, we don't have to work for you. We can work for your competitor. And how do you know that we're not having discussions with your competitor? Because what we have got is incredibly valuable. And let me explain to you why it's incredibly valuable. And then they would do that. And they would then talk about results. And they would show charts which showed the client's performance against the Standard & Poor's index or against competitors in the industry. And the Bain clients, since they started working with them, would always experience, nearly always, experience a huge uptick in value, doubling, tripling, 10 times, 20 times, or whatever. And that was because Bain & Company then got to work and they tried to find out which businesses were star businesses and which businesses were not. They would get out of all the businesses. They would sell all the other businesses if they possibly could and persuade the chief executive to and the board of directors to do that. And they would just focus on that very few parts of the business, the segments, the businesses where they were star businesses. And even in those businesses, they would look again at another level. They would say, well, it's a star business overall, but there are these activities which are not star, and we'll get rid of them. So we'll get other people to do our manufacturing for us, or we get other people to do our marketing for us, unless we were, you know, unquestionably sort of brilliant at that. And they'd focus on the part of the value chain where the company had got greatest competitive advantage, and they'd get rid of everything else. So it was classic 80-20 principle, but with huge chutzpah. You know, there's no other way of describing it. You know, talking to these chief executives and saying, if we do a good job for you, we will not work for your competitors and you will not work for ours.
Okay.
And no consultant ever said that to a chief executive before. McKinsey, the prime consulting firm at boardroom level for something 30, 40 years beforehand, and still today the largest. You know, they would never ever say anything as dramatic as that because they worked for several different companies in the same industry.
Okay, they couldn't afford to, yeah.
Head-to-head competitors, and they said, we have Chinese walls and all the rest of it. So an upstart like Bain & Company, which was very much smaller and didn't have all these, the problem of conflicts of interest, could make a virtue out of necessity from that point of view because I had no clients to start with
in but
particular
I'm,
industry.
And I'm curious, Richard, if you we'll relate that to today, say that again?
Is it still true today? No, I don't think Bain & Company doesn't do that today because they're too successful.
What I'm curious about today is if you look at a company like Elon Musk, SpaceX, where they go out of their way to try and make everything themselves. What are your thoughts on that approach? I mean, it's completely different. What would be the rationale? They seem to be doing well. No, could they be doing better?
No, they do. And in fact, I think SpaceX could well become the most valuable company in the world in the next 5 years. So what am I talking about? Well, there's another great principle which says that the opposite of a trivial truth is a lie. But the opposite of a great truth is another great truth. And so you can actually break the rules and do it differently. I mean, look at the car industry at the time that the cars started being made in large numbers. Henry Ford said, I'm going to make the lowest cost car. And that was fantastically successful for about 15 years. And then General Motors came along and said, we're going to make a series of cars, and there'll be one for each pocket, one for each segment. And basically, if once you get more money, you can leave your Cadillac behind and have a Chevrolet, or is it the other way around? The other way around, isn't it? But you know, so they instead of focusing on reducing everything, they actually focused on adding value through marketing and through building in extra value. And you could say the same thing about about the iPhone and the iPad and the iTunes and all of the eyes that again, Steve Jobs had the obsession with end-to-end, doing everything, you know, he did software and hardware, whereas previously everyone had separated those two. And that was very successful. So, I mean, there are different rules that apply to those different sites. I discuss those in my book, Simplify. And it's I say there are two completely opposite ways of simplifying. And basically, the two that I've just mentioned, one is you'll go for the low-cost position, and the other is you make a product which is so fantastic that people will pay ridiculous amounts of money for it. And both of those can be hugely successful.
Okay, so
the Ford category or the
iPhone. I mean, so that sounds to me that SpaceX is a star business, quite literally.
Yes, indeed, quite literally. No, I think space. I mean, their biggest business is, again, you've got to segment it. But I understand it's these satellites, which are, you know, they've got many, many more satellites than other people, and they're hugely expensive, and they're just buying and putting up more and more of these things, and that's it's going to give them a virtual monopoly in that business.
Yeah, it is so incredible.
Yes,
this.
It doesn't help you because you can't buy shares in SpaceX. But I'd love to if I could.
Well,
I think Musk. Do you know Elon yourself? Have you come across him as being?
I live in the same city where he went to school, but alas, no. In fact, he went to school about 5 kilometers from my house. But no, I don't know him. But maybe I'll get to interview him one day too.
But there are very mixed stories about him personally. But he's a genius. He's an absolute genius, as he would be the first to tell you.
Well, he certainly knows how to wind people up. He seems to be having a lot of fun with Jeff Bezos at the moment. And one of the people on your list is Jeff Bezos, and you've mentioned Steve Jobs as well. And if we jump into Unreasonable Success and How to Achieve It, I really enjoyed that book, by the way, and this is where we got our conversation kicked off. Interesting, the group of people that you've chosen, Bill Bain, Jeff Bezos, Bismarck, Churchill, Marie Curie, Da Vinci, etc. I can read them all. However, you know, most of these, the 80-20 principle, 80% of this list is known by just a one name, like a Madonna, Mandela, Dylan, Einstein. I mean, how did you come across this list, and why are these people more special than anybody else? What is it that attracted you to this crowd of people, which are very, very well known, and they're all very different?
I started somewhere else rather than with the people. I started by asking the question, why is it that some people are more successful, dramatically more successful, outrageously, or as I call it, unreasonably more successful than other people? Why is it? And I started with all the explanations that any writer, has come up with. So some people talk about grit, for example, the idea that you basically keep at it and you're sort of, you know, determined to do it. Other people talk about taking huge risks, that the universe favors those who take the biggest risks and so on and so forth. And other people talked about hard work. Other people talk about the sort of leadership qualities that they have. I came up with a list of 50 attributes. And then I said, okay, what I want to do is to pick some people who are unquestionably much more successful than other people, but also perhaps much more successful than people expected them to be when they were early in their careers. People who had often got great intuition, and they were unreasonably successful in that sense that it wasn't based on reason. It was based on some instinct or some sixth sense or whatever. And no one would argue Winston Churchill wasn't very successful. No, I don't think many people would argue that Dylan isn't, really interesting, not just singer, but songwriter, perhaps more than that, and poet, basically. For once, the Nobel Committee got it right. And, Margaret Thatcher, that no one thought would possibly become prime minister. And if she did, she would be a complete disaster, which she was for the first 3 years premiership. And Nelson Mandela, completely obscure lawyer, you know, until he met Walter Sisulu and the other people from the ANC. People that you would never expect to become outrageously successful. And what I did was to look at these 50 attributes, and I had a matrix, I had the 20 people, and I had the 50 people in columns. And unless there was a tick against all of the 20 people for some attribute, then I discarded it. So, for example, I was completely convinced when I started that I'd have a group of 20 high-risk takers. And about, and I think it was 9 of the 20 actually did take some really serious risks, including Mandela, who could easily have been hung. Some of them didn't. Bruce Henderson never really took a risk in his life. He only started the Boston Consulting Group because he had been fired from a couple of jobs in quick succession and didn't know what to do. And he started as, you know, one person, no secretary, no office or tiny table, desk, a telephone, nothing apart from that. And, you know, he was just very good at what he did, and it's the momentum built from there. Bezos, you know, Jeff Bezos, probably the most single-minded of all of these people. But you could reduce that in his case to having very high expectations and imposing very high expectations on other people. So, you know, completely like Steve Jobs, the opposite of what you're supposed to do in terms of a stereotype of, you know, a good manager. You know,
can I just interrupt for a sec there, Richard? So you said you started with the landmarks rather than the people. So to distill down from this big matrix of 20 odd things, and it became 9. But when did the people start featuring in? How did you have a list of 100 people to begin with, or 1,000 people, or so that the matrix of the landmarks comes first? And who did you check off?
Good question. No. What happened was I started with the 20 people that I said were. I just picked them. I just said, you know, do I know? And preferably knew personally, or knew some people who knew them, or if they were dead, I'd actually studied them. And, you know, Otto von Bismarck, for example, was someone that I felt intimately familiar with, despite the fact that he died 150 years before. You know.
Okay. All right.
And so the most successful statesman in Europe for the 19th century, during the whole 19th century, I think quite objectively. So I started with these very successful people, and then I started with, you said, called them landmarks, and that's what I eventually did call them, but these 50 possible reasons. And then I said, unless they all have really unusually high expectations, that would be junked off the list. Self-belief, unless they had, you know, you're talking about Musk, you know, sort of enormous heads, really, in many respects. Unless they had huge confidence in what they were going to do, then they were off the list, and so on. So I eventually ended up with 9 observations, which all 20 of them fulfilled, each one of those 9. And then I thought, well, perhaps I got it right. You could have done it a different way. So it's slightly subjective because, you know, you call it self-belief, you might have called it overwhelming passion to do things, or extreme ambition, or something like that. But, you know, these 9 things which are in the book, they all had. And I was really thrilled by it because many of these people, I didn't know. I mean, obviously I knew quite a lot about them, but I didn't know whether or not they had, for example, had enormous self-belief, and where did it come from? You know, so I looked at that in all cases, and you usually found that they didn't start with enormous self-belief, but there was some stage, some crisis in their life, or something that happened to them, or they were very lucky in some respects, or they had a very unfortunate experience, like being in a concentration camp for Viktor Frankl, who was one of the 20 people. But if it hadn't been for Hitler, no one would have heard of of Frankl. In fact, many people haven't heard of him, but he has written a book which has sold something like 100 million copies, so he's not someone to ignore. You know, they had experiences or they had some intrinsic skills which made them very successful. But in most cases, they were not absolutely brilliant. And there's a fascinating thing about Albert Einstein. Everyone thinks Einstein is a synonym for, you know, someone with an IQ of 200 or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about the IQ of Einstein, and I'm not saying that I'm brighter than he was, but I do know that he went to a school in Zurich, which wasn't the best school, polytechnic there. I do know that he came near the bottom of his class. And I do know, like me, he can't add up. You know, it's one of these things, calculator to be able to do things. And he got his girlfriend to check his arithmetic. So, I mean, what he was absolutely brilliant at was thinking from first principles and constructing metaphors like the trains that come together, trying to explain relativity. And even now, it's very difficult to understand relativity. But he made it vaguely comprehensible. And certainly he discovered it. And certainly, you know, when they did the calculations and movements of the planet according to the relativity theory, he was proved to be spot on. But he didn't do any research. I mean, that's a very interesting thing. He never did any research. And you think scientists all do research. He came up with ideas and other people did the research to validate it.
Well, that leads me to my question on this, actually. I'm curious about did this start as an idea on a long walk and you thought, well, these are people that I'm fascinated by. I wonder if I do a bit of reading about them, if I'll find something. Where did the idea of the book, I mean, it wasn't obviously a book at the first point. It was a cycle, thinking about some people that were churning around in your head. Where did the idea of the book come and what kind of research did you do about this?
It actually came on a train this time. I mean, I'm a great believer in walking and cycling and getting ideas, but this was a train. I see if I got the book over here. But it's a book called Outliers.
And Malcolm Gladwell.
This is Malcolm Gladwell. Yeah. And he tried to say what it was that made people very successful. And he came up with a theory, not nine ideas, but one idea, which was they'd had 10,000 hours of experience. So he gave the example of the Beatles. He said the Beatles were a mediocre high school band. And then they went to the strip clubs of Hamburg. And they worked in the strip clubs of Hamburg for, you know, 80 hours a week, seven days a week, 10 hours, 12 hours a day. And John Lennon said, we couldn't help but get better. So, you know, the idea was that you just needed 10,000 hours of very intensive experience. And some people in the book, and some people are not in the book, but clearly unreasonably successful, like Bill Gates, you know, do fit that profile, but they knew about computers long before other people did, and they had experience in programming when nobody else could do programming. They say it applies to Tiger Woods and various other people. Well, it does work for some people, but, you know, most of the people who were in my book never had 10,000 hours experience, intensive experience at a critical stage in their career. It's not that they didn't accumulate experience. That was an explanation which worked for some people, didn't work for other people, and it was just one explanation. So I said, well, can I do what Malcolm Gladwell, who I think is a fantastic writer, much more successful than me in selling books, at least? What could I do to actually, not to say Gladwell was wrong, but to say this is how you distill success. And this is a relationship, rather loose relationship, between the 80-20 principle and unreasonable success. I've always tried to reduce things, you know, and that's why I like sort of low-cost businesses perhaps more than the great businesses of Elon Musk and Steve Jobs. All credit to them, they're fantastic. But, you know, I said, can we actually say that there are nine things that you, experiences you need to have, or attributes and ways of attitudes, really, that you need to have in order to be successful? Because then anybody can be successful. And I really believe that if they had not had, some of these people, if they had not had particular experiences at a particular critical time, if I had not been transformed from one person to another, it's one of the most interesting things that I describe in the book are transforming experiences.
Sure.
If I hadn't have had that, they wouldn't be known to any of us today. And then my point is to try and get more and more unreasonably successful people. And so it's a kind of, you know, paint by numbers sort of thing. Yeah. If you haven't had a transforming experience, go and get one, because you won't be unreasonably successful if you want to be unreasonably successful without it. And most people
have you tried your matrix that you've got, your 9 landmarks? Have you just as a fun experiment grabbed another 30 or 40 or 100 successful people and tried to plug them in just to see how that worked out? Maybe an Elon Musk or
no? I haven't. In fact, I wanted to write a sequel. I wanted to write a sequel like that. There were some people who didn't make it into the book. Hitler was in the book, and Hitler absolutely fitted the profile to a T. And I thought it was terribly interesting how he was transformed from someone who was antisocial. No one had got a good word for Adolf. He was an outcast. He was a bum. He was living on the street in Vienna for a lot of the time before the First World War. He wanted to be an artist. He got rejected by the Vienna School of Art twice. And he ended up sort of producing pretty postcards and selling those, actually rather amusingly, through a Jewish shopkeeper in Vienna. And, you know, everyone thought Adolf was odd, but nobody thought that he would be successful. In fact, he always remained a Lance Corporal because, according to the official records, he didn't have the German word for leadership qualities, which has got the word Führer in it. So he, you know, he became the Führer. And the reason he became the Führer was the First World War. Firstly, gave him discipline and self-confidence. But secondly, immediately after the Second World War, there was a social revolution in Bavaria, Munich in particular, where the army sided with the communists. And the federal government decided that they had better eliminate this, and there was very bloody battles, and they basically killed most of the ringleaders and many of the troops. But then that made the army realize that they needed to engage in propaganda and convince the soldiers that Germany was great, and that, you know, all this sort of, you know, ideas which were the feedstock of National Socialism, which were, you know, Germany didn't lose the First World War. They were stabbed in the back by the other countries and other people and by the leaders in Germany who gave up. Germany, you know, Germans had a right to basically rule Europe. That the biggest problem, well, two biggest problems in the world were the Jews and communism. So, you know, that they had these ideas, and they indoctrinated these ideas within the army. And they had 16, I think it was, instructors who went round, basically going through all of the army people, giving them lectures and telling them what they ought to believe. And Adolf Hitler was the most successful person at doing it. And he discovered that he could rant and rave and be regarded as being a terrific orator. And if it hadn't been for being handed that job, you know, we'd never have heard about Adolf Hitler, and the world would be a much happier place. But, you know, from his point of view, that was a transforming experience, absolutely transforming. And it's a really fascinating thing.
Well, there's a couple
of things. My publishers wouldn't let me put it in the
book. Yeah. Besides the Adolf Hitler part of the draft, I suppose, not because it's not in the book, I'm curious about one or two things. Firstly, was there something on the matrix, because this is how I think and I would have operated, was there something on the matrix where you, Richard, thought, I would like to maybe have a bite to eat with a person? Was there any fascination about the person? Because from my point of view, I went through a transformative experience last year when I was retrenched from the airline industry. And, you know, a lot of people around the world went through a similar thing during this COVID last year. However, I now have a podcast and I can reach a lot of people. And part of this podcast is just for me to meet great people and like an experiment and a study like you've done with Unreasonable Success. It would be almost fascinating for me to just reach out to people, and it's people I'm just curious about and I wouldn't mind having a beer with. Was there anything in that in your study?
Yes, I think it was that. It was a fascination with how they'd been successful, but the only problem with having a beer with them is that they wouldn't tell you the truth, unless you wanted to adopt, you know, very well, the sort of interviewing techniques that we were talking about earlier, where you try and skewer them and say, well, isn't it true, Mrs. Thatcher, that if you hadn't married Dennis, you'd never have been able to become a lawyer and you'd never have become a Conservative MP. And I can imagine Margaret Thatcher saying to me, nonsense, Richard. but you don't necessarily. You get the myth created after people are very successful, and they don't like to be reminded that it was partly due to the circumstances and luck. Alex, I've got to go. I've got another.
It's
phone
been
call,
wonderful. Yeah,
in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Time.
Yeah, Richard, it's been a wonderful conversation.
Terrific. And
when you are next in Cape Town, it would be great to connect.
Like this in person, yes.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much for your time.
Have a good afternoon now. Good evening.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high performance team.